Reminds me of the class I wanted to train its professor. So what it did was, when the professor started to talk, at the beginning everybody paid attention, but eventually what they decided was when he goes to one half of the room, they should listen intently. When he goes to the second half of the room, they should not pay attention. Eventually they got him into the first half of the room, and then they decided that they were going to specialize and they're going to cut it down even a little bit more. Eventually, they got him to lecture from the door. That's me. I would like that to be here. In the meantime, I'm going to be over there. I'll do the best I can. All right, this morning's talk is named as this plea, Understanding the Midrashic Disputes Between Rabbi Yeshua and Hananiah and Rabbi Eliezer of Rodian. And this is part of the Encyclopedia of Talmudic Disputes and Perspectives project, which I am doing at YU. These are two book covers of actually the same sefer. One came out earlier, and this is part of the encyclopedia cover. You'll see a whole series of them if you'd like in the bookstore, and you can either buy them or not, it's fine. It gives me also a special pleasure, a little bit of hashgacha, although we had said that I would give this talk in the middle of the summer, it was set, but through Hashgacha, my neighbor, Stewie and Ella Chaffin, are dedicating the shiur this morning for their mothers and grandmother, the mothers I knew. They're very nice ladies, and I hope that they all have an aliyah. What we're going to do this morning is to discuss here what's called Esther's plea. And with regard to Esther's plea, we have two issues that were raised by Esther to the Chachamim. One involves the question of Tivuni Lidoros, the question of celebrating Purim annually, and the second is the canonization of the Megillah. Now, there's Esther wrote a Megillah. The question became, should that Megillah become part of Tanakh? And what we're going to discuss this morning is that second issue. So, first of all, I just will cite to you the Gemara. So we have, the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel Rabbi Yehuda, Shalchol Lahem Esther L'Chachomim. The Esther sent to the Chachomim, and whatever is in brackets here is really Rashi. Shona Shnia L'Kova Lein Kova. The first year, obviously, they observed the Yontif of Purim. I don't use the word Yontif halachically. It is mentioned in the Megillah once as a Yom Tov, but it was not accepted as such. But she said, Kivuni Lidoros, I want to make this into an annual affair. I want you to make sure that each and every year at this date, this Yontif is celebrated by the populace. Lios Lilashem, so that the event will have a certain amount of lasting power. So Shol Kulah, they responded to her, Kinat Lores Aleinu Levein Ha'umos, you want to create jealousy, that we are celebrating the downfall. 75,000 people were killed, according to the Megillah. So she answered them, listen, it's not really a problem whether or not you choose to put it, whether you or not you choose to celebrate it, because the fact of the matter is, what happened is known, it's in the Chronicles. So it really doesn't make a difference on any level whether or not you establish it as such or not. Okay. Okay. Do the best we can. Okay, so now, then came the second request. The second request was, Tisfuni Lidoros. So she sent to the Chachamim, and she said, put me into Tanakh. So they answered her, there is a pasuk, which we're going to go into in a second, which says, Halo pasakti v'chashlishim. I already, the story of Amalek, was already written three times. Once it's written three times, there's no need for it to be written again. Now, where is it written three times? This we find in Mishlei, which says, Hat oznecho shma divrei chachomim v'lib chotoshes ledati lios v'ashem niftachacha lo'odiacha hayom ani afata halokosavti l'cho shalishim v'moatzos v'das. In other words, the Rebbeinu Shlom says, I want you to take to heart all that I have promised you, and in order for you to take it to heart, I have written it down in the three sections of Tanakh, the Torah, Nevi'im, Uksuvim. That's Rashi's interpretation on Mishlei. But according to the Chachamim, they don't understand it that way. According to the Chachamim, what it means is that the story of Amalek is specifically to be written Shalishim. It's specifically to be written only three times, and not four times. Now, this created a problem, as you well know, because in the Torah, we have the incident written twice. One is, Vayomer Shemosh Ksov, so that is written at the end of Parshas Bishalach. And then we find at the end of Ki Seitzah, and then in Shmuel Aleph, the whole story, which we read in the Haftorah, of Shmuel sending Shaul to wipe out Amalek. So they came to Esther, and they said, it's written three times already. Once it's written three times, it cannot be written again. So therefore, if you look at the second paragraph, Ad she'motzu lo mikra kosov v'torah, k'sov zos yikorim ba'sefer. So they darshan as follows, k'sov zos, you should write this, ma she'kosov kan uve mishnah Torah. In other words, the Rashi says, zos ma she'kosov kan mishnah Torah, the kol ma she'kosov ba'torah, korek sab echot. Now, it says, it doesn't matter
the fact that it's written in the Shalach and again in Kiseitze,
because it's really talking about one event. So that in Mishlei, when it says, I wrote it for you three times, okay, this is not a problem. Because what that means is there are three distinct points in history in which the battle of Amalek is going to be waged, and those should be written. Hence, they found a makor that they should write a separate Megillah. All right, she wanted more than the Megillah. What she wanted is that should be put in Tanakh. Now, there are a lot of halachic issues here with regard to whether the Megillah is a Megillah, as we call it, or it's a Sefer, one of the 24 Svarim that are found in Tanakh. As a matter of fact, when we read the Megillah, the Megillah has to be read as a Megillah. So let's say somebody has Megillahs that are part of the Tanakh in a scroll. So the halacha is, if you read from that Megillah, you're not Yotzer. The Gemara says you can only do it if those parchments are larger or smaller than the subsequent scroll that you have. In other words, it has to be demarcated. You cannot read it as a Sefer. You essentially have to read it as a Megillah. But what we do find is that the Gemara then tells us something very interesting. The first Brisa seemed to say, okay, Esther wanted Kavuni Lidoros, Kasuni Lidoros, and in the end the Chachamim gave in. But then the Gemara goes on to say, it's not true. That in fact, it is a machlokes between two Tanoim, Rabbi Loza Hamudoi and Rabbi Yehoshua. And basically, what we have here is that Rabbi Yehoshua is not maskev. I mean, Rabbi Yehoshua basically says, so zos mashikosov kan, zikaron mashikosov in Devarim, which is in Tiseitze, and mashikosov benevi'im. And that's what you do. Now, according to Rabbi Yehoshua, Esther should not be part of Tanakh. Whereas Rabbi Loza Hamudoi, he says, Esther should be part of Tanakh based on the limud that we had in the first Brisa. So in other words, Rabbi Yeshua says the Shlishim is based on the entries, all right, how many times in Tanakh is the war with Amalek mentioned, whereas Rabbi Loza Hamudoi says no, it's based on the episodes. And the fact is that if we mention or we describe the same war twice, it's only one episode and we don't have to worry about it. But this raises a question. The question is, I don't have the joke, I don't know what it's happening, okay. But the point is, Esther had already been canonized over four centuries. In other words, one of the problems we have when we learn Gemara is somehow we always look at the Gemara two-dimensionally. In other words, everything is happening at the same time, the same day, the same year. Everybody is living exactly the same time. We don't really sort of take into account that different things are happening at different times. So the point here is, Rabbi Elazar Modoy, as we will see, and Rabbi Yeshua, they lived approximately 400 years, 450 years, after the Anshei Knesset Hagdola. They lived at the later end of the temple period. And we know from a Tosefta, the Braisa, in Baba Basra, that the Anshei Knesset Hagdola already established Esther. Okay? So the Brice is well known. It spells out what the Seder of the Nevi'im are, Yeshua, Shofar, Shmuel, Melachim, Yirmiyah, Yechezkel, Yeshaya, Shneimasar. And then you have Bixuven, all right? And you see in red that the Megillas Esther is one of those Svarim which are mentioned as the 24 Svarim in Tanakh. And then they ask the question of who wrote it. So it says Moshe wrote the Chumash, the Parashah of Bilam and Iyov. Yeshua wrote the last eight psukim of the Torah, according to some understandings, aside from the Sefer of Yeshua. Shmuel wrote Shmuel, Shoftim, and Rus. David wrote Tillim with 10 individuals. Yirmiyah wrote Yirmiyah, Melachim, and Echa. And Chizkiah and his group, all right, they wrote Yeshaya, Mishlei, and Shir Hashir. Now, interestingly enough, what it says is that the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, who were composed of Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, Zerubbabel, Mordechai, and their friends, and they were established at the beginning of the Second Commonwealth when the Jews came back to Israel. At that time, it says the Anshei Knesset HaGedola wrote Yechezkel, Shemosa, Daniel, and the Megillas Esther. So of course the question is a simple question. In other words, Yirmiyah wrote Yirmiyah, Yeshayah wrote Yeshayah, so why didn't Yechezkel write Yechezkel? And he had written other things, so why didn't he write this? So there's a point which Rashi makes. It says, the reason it was done is because the Nevuah of Yechezkel took place outside of Eretz Yisrael. And he says, that the nevuah should not be written down. That is, in Yechezkel's case, he was allowed to give the nevuah in Chutz Laretz, but it shouldn't be written down. And the same would be with Esther. The reason Esther wasn't included was for that reason. Even though it says Vatichtov Esther, nevertheless, again, this is the question of the Megillah, and this is the question of Tanakh. So you see that Esther was already included in Tanakh. So Esther was already included in Tanakh at the time of the Anshei Knesset Hagdola. One has to ask, what is it that Rabbi Elazar HaModoy and Rabbi Yehoshua, what is it that they were arguing about 450 years later, should we include Esther in Tanakh or not? So the question then comes up. If that's the question we just asked. So the first thing we have to, I don't, you have to. The first thing I do when I see a machlokes between two Tanoim or two Amoroyim is I always ask myself, who is it that are the disputants? Who are they? Who are they? Because are they just giving an ad hoc opinion to one case? Or is there something which is really deeper? All right? Do they argue in other places? Is there any pattern to the disputes? And what are their halachic and hashkafic perspectives? So that, I can't even tell you what prompted me to write the Sefer, but for some reason, maybe it was one Purim, I sat down before the Suda to learn this, and I asked myself simply, who are these individuals? And, you know, today with all of the devices we have, I found out the following. The first is they don't argue in the Talmud Bavli at all. They don't argue in the Yerushalmi. It could be in later times, I maybe found one machlokas, but that's it. They don't argue in Medrash Rabbah. However, and this is the point, there are halachic medrashim. One such sefer on Shmos is known as the Mechilta the Rav Yishmael. In that sefer, they argue 41 times, one after another. And where is it? These disputes span from post-Yom Suf to the beginning of Yisrael. As last week, previous 2 weeks, Sedras, this is where you'll find all of these machloksim. Now, what is their fundamental dispute? Now, this sefer, which I'm only really going to speak about the first few, I guess, 30 pages or so, this sefer really breaks down all of the machloksim they have in the Mechilta, and basically what I show is that they have completely different perspectives of the level of the Jewish people when they left Mitzrayim. Rabbi Elazar Mardoi, as we will see, is a Kabbalist, and he took the high road that Klal Yisrael with Tzadikim Gemurim, one step away from being Malachim. And therefore, he explains the psukim based on that perspective. Whereas Rabbi Yehoshua basically took the perspective that they were not, that the Jewish people of that era were not ro'i l'geula. They were not really worthy of being redeemed, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu redeemed them nonetheless. So you have really two different perspectives. And then when you think about it in real reality, what you probably find is both are true, all right? It's just a question of which segment of Klal Yisrael you're looking at. The Elazar Mardoi believed that they were on a very high spiritual plane, and Rabbi Yehoshua maintained that they were on a low spiritual plane. Okay, now, let's begin with a quick biography of Rabbi Yehoshua's life. Rabbi Yehoshua was a Levi, okay? But more interesting for our purpose is he was a singer in the Holy Temple. That means we know about him that not only was he a Levi, but he was a Levi who lived during the time of the Beis HaMikdash, and in fact, he was a singer among the Levim. And this we know from the story in Erchin, where he had his Rebbe, Yochanan ben Gudgudah, and what happened was his Rebbe was having problems closing one of the doors in the Beis HaMikdash, and you know that the Levim were divided into two parts. There were the Meshorarim and the Shoarim. Actually, if you are on your way to the Kotel, they actually have two such streets. I think where Rabbi Bean lives, you have to make the left, like right before that is the Shoarim Street. And then there's another street, the Meshorarim Street. So this is labeled in terms of the Levim and their jobs, but the halacha was that if you were of one group, you really were not allowed to help out in the other group, and that's what the Gemara is talking about in this. So we know he worked in the Beis HaMikdash. Interestingly enough, and I'm sure you know this, he also gave us tremendous insights, and one of the insights he gave us was a real live account of what the Simchas Beis HaShoeva on Sukkot was all about. So he says, during the whole week of Sukkot, Kishayinu Smechem Simchas Beis HaShoeva, Lo Ro'inu Sheino B'Yeneinu. We didn't sleep. Ketzer. All right, so here was the Seder Hayom. They began first by observing the bringing of the Korban Tumim, the morning Tumim. After that, they went to Daven Shachris. After that, they Daven Musa. They went to see the Hakrova of the Korban Musaf. After that, they Daven Musaf. After Musaf, they went and they learned. After they learned, what did they do? They went to eat in the Sukkah, in the Sukkahs. After that, they Daven Mincha. After Mincha, they went to see the Hakrova of the Korban Mincha. And of course here, if you notice carefully, this is a difference in Seder. When it came to Shachris and Musaf, first the Korban was brought, right? And then they davened. It came to Mincha, it was the opposite, which prompted the Rama of Pano in one of his tshuvas to wonder why it is that the Sfardim or the Eda Mizrachit, when they say Karbonos by Mincha, why don't they say the Karbonos after the Tefillah? Why did they say the Karbonos? He doesn't have an answer for that question. And then it says Mikan Be'elech L'Simchas Beis HaShoev. So that's insight from somebody who was there. The Gemara asks, how could they not sleep for 7 days? The Gemara says, if you make a neder that after that you won't sleep, that you will not sleep for more than 3 days, they give you malchus and you have to sleep, because a person cannot not sleep for more than 3 days. So the Gemara says they actually were standing in a circle, and when they got tired, they sort of slept standing up, holding on to the chaverim, but they stood, and that was it. I have a few funny stories I could tell you now, but I'm not. All right. Now, of course, you know that Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya was a disciple of Yochanan ben Zakkai, mentioned in Pirkei Avos. Among his students, Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, Rabbi Yossi ben Hoyer, Rabbi Shimon ben Asano, and Rabbi Elazar ben Aruch. Now, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he said of Rabbi Yeshua, Ashrei Yoladeta. Okay? Happy is the mother who gave birth to him. I made the background of this page orange. The screen is not so orange. I did that in honor of my friend Stewie, which has his favorite color. And I did it specifically because of the comment of Tiferes Yisrael here, where Tiferes Yisrael says, Ashrei Yoladeto, Sh'imo Hadrichoso L'Toru L'Midas Yisharos. Because why did he become so great? Because his mother was the one that led him on the path of Torah and Midos. Once she became pregnant, when she was carrying him, alright, and that's the way it is throughout the generations, that mothers have had a tremendous influence upon their children. Now, we know, this is a story we tell always on Tisha B'Av, that he was involved in a very, very important incident. You know that when there was a siege of Yerushalayim for a number of years, there were divisions among the populace in terms of how it is that they should relate to the Romans. And you had one zealot group, which is the Barone, and they were zealous. They wanted to go down to the last man. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he felt that it was pointless, because when it's over, it's over. And one has to understand that the time comes and you sort of have to give in. So he felt that he had to get out and he had to try to talk to the general who eventually became one of the Caesars of Rome. Now, he called his nephew, Abisikra, and he says, what are you doing? You're just going to destroy all of the people of Jerusalem. He says, listen, I know you're right, but one of the problems zealots have is that they don't have the option of giving up on their zealotry. Because once they do that, you know what happens to them? All right, basically they get shot. Who do they get shot by? Their own men. And that happens over and over and over again in history. And it happens in many walks of life, which I'm not going to go into right now. But in other words, you can't give in. But he devised the plan, again, which you know because you've heard the story many times, he devised the plan of how he could smuggle Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai out from the Brione. He basically said that he has to pretend that he's sick, he has to make a Pearson, publicize that he's sick. Eventually, it should be publicized that he died. He should take some sour-smelling items, so it should smell like his body is decomposing, and then he should have his disciples carry him out. And who were the disciples? The famous Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Eliezer. And that's what happened. As they got to the perimeter, which was guarded by the Rione, they didn't want to let him out. They thought that this was a sham. Of course, they were right. And they said, okay, he's dead. Let's make sure he's dead. And one of them took a bayonet and was about to stick it into his body. And Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer prevailed upon him not to do so. So eventually they let him out. He then, and the idea of letting him out was he was going to be buried outside of Yerushalayim. You're not allowed to be buried in Yerushalayim. So awesome. To deal with that. But once he got out, he made the famous meeting. And from the meeting we have, as you know, that he had three pleas, the most famous of which is Tainli, Yavna, V'chachomel. Whether it's he pleaded, says the city is gone, the Jewish population is destroyed, but I at least plead with you that you should grant safe passage to Yavna and Chachomel and its wise men. It's a certain parallel to the Miri Yeshiva coming out of Europe when it came out. So you see that he basically was an active player. However, after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and Yeshua settled in Pekin, those of you who have never been to Pekin, I was there. It's a city you should visit for its historical content. Pekin is up north. What do I say here? It's in the Galil between Yavne and Lod. It is said it was an era Kohanim, and that Jews, except for a very, very short period from the destruction of the Temple until the modern state of Israel, were living there continuously. At this point, when I was there, there really was only one family, and I think she was already in her late 90s or early 100s. And I think they had a picture in one of the original dollar bills of Israel where they had a mock-up of Pekin. And in Pekin is where he set up his base medrash, as we find in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, where it says, Tzedek, Tirdof, you should always look for a competent base then. So, Acher, Rabbi Yeshua, Lepekin. Whether it's in Pekin, that is where he had his base medrash. I just put this in because it was a co-inhabitant of Pekin. Rabbi Yeshua in Hananya, the rabbi we're talking about, was the leading rabbi of Beis Hillel at one point. I say at one point because I'm writing a sefer now about Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. And of course, one of the things that we really don't know after people are trying to work on this for a long time is it's very hard to really establish a time when the quote Beis Shammai began and when Beis Shammai ended. So I thought that there was a span of time that he was considered to be the leading rabbi of Beis Hillel. While he was spiritually wealthy, he earned his living as a blacksmith and was monetarily quite poor. Nevertheless, because he was a prominent member of the Sanhedrin, Rabbi Yeshua mingled with the upper echelon of Roman society. And again, those of you who have the opportunity to go to Tzipori and to see where the seat of the Sanhedrin was, and to see where all of the shuls were, and to see at the same time the places nearby where the Romans set up their amphitheater and their culture, and it was a place that they visited during the summer, clearly there was a lot of interaction which took place. He was among the group of rabbis who traveled to Rome to entreat Nerva to be lenient toward the Jews. Now, there was an emperor Nerva. He didn't live long as a Caesar. He lived, they say, around 18 months. And during that period, it was crucial at certain times, because they were passing certain taxes against the Jews, that the rabbis felt that they had to go to Rome and they had to try to get on Nerva's good side. This is a picture of Nerva. I don't know that he is redheaded, but that's the way the picture is. So, and we see that the rabbis, in fact, rushed to get there, and they rushed and went there at a time which was not easy for them, which was on Sukkot. Because we have the story of Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Shur, Rabbi Losa ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, Shehayu bo in Bismina. These rabbis were, I guess from the picture you can see they were a glass bottom boat, because you can see the fish. Rabbi Gamliel was the only one who had a lulav, and the Gemara is teaching you the halacha of Maton al Menas Lahachzir, that a lulav has to be yours. At the same time, you can give it to someone else, but with the proviso that it be given back. So that's what we learned from the Smaisa. But the idea of why were they going specifically at that time, that's not the time they should be going to Rome. Because if they were there then, they must not be there for Yom Leroy also. Why? So the answer is because Nero was dying. Not Nero, Nerva was dying. And they had to get there on time, and they were, in fact, able to reverse the tax that was imposed. After that, you have the death of Nerva. After Nerva's death, you had Marcus Trajan, and he was a terrible ruler as far as the Jews were concerned. He ruled approximately 19 years, and at that time, he set down some Jewish revolts, and he supervised the burning of one of the Jewish synagogues in Egypt. Following him came Hadrian. Now, that was interesting, because Hadrian, if you will, was, quote, a friend of the Jews. All right, he was much more pleasant in his outlook towards the Jews, and the Gemara relates, and the Midrashim relate a number of conversations which took place between Hadrian and our Rabbi Yehoshua. And because of that, Rabbi Yehoshua felt somewhat emboldened, and he had high hopes for the future. Now we come to a well-known Gemara. This Gemara you learned in Yeshiva, and many of you had the opportunity to re-study it with your children and grandchildren. This is one of the stories that are taught to younger children. And that is the famous story where Rav Shimon ben Yochai, quote, troublemaker, introduced the following question. The question is, with regard to Ma'ariv, Ma'ariv prayer, is the Ma'ariv prayer a reshus, or is the Ma'ariv prayer a chovah? In other words, is it a prayer that you must pray every night, or is it a prayer that you can voluntarily pray, but you're not obligated to do so? So the story goes that Rav Shimon ben Yochai here says Talmud Echad, but the Gemara says that Rav Shimon ben Yochai, he asked this question, and Rabbi Shua answered, it's voluntary. Rabbi Gamliel came, and is it Rishus HaChovah? Rabbi Gamliel says, it's a chovah. It's obligatory. So Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says, but Rabbi Shua says, it's a Rishus. So he says, okay, let's see what he really holds. So he said, come back later when all of the big guns are here. He poses the question again to Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Yeshua this time says that it is mandatory. Okay, now Rabbi Gamliel gets angry because he says, I know that previously you said it was voluntary. So therefore, what happened is, so he says to Yeshua, Amod al Rablecha, Yidubach. What happened was he got very, very angry at him, and he punished him. He said that he had to stand throughout the entire lecture. The rabbis were very upset by this, and you know that this led to the disposition of Rabbi Gamliel. They removed him from his nesiyot because of this. Later, they sort of had to back up a little bit, so they worked out a program where 3 weeks there was the other one, the new one, which is the Haggadah. I discussed this in my Haggadah. All right, Hari Yikiven Shivim Shana, okay, Os Hayom. And in 1 week, Rabbi Gamliel was the Nasi. But the question that one has to ask is as follows. Those who are versed in Talmud, note that there is not a page of the Talmud which is bereft of machlokas. The Velt says that the reason that we say the parak of Ezer HaMakomon in the morning is because it's not the only parak in all of Shas that you can go through without a machlokas. So machlokas on every page of Shas. The fact that rabbis have questions posed to them is not new. The fact that they have a disciple or a companion that disagrees with them, that's also not new. So the question you have to ask is, when you read this, why is it that Rabbi Gamliel got so excited? Why was this question so important? So the only way I can explain it to you, I think that you can understand it, and most of you are sort of in my age bracket, so maybe you can understand it better than some of the younger people. And that is, you know what that question is? You know what he was asking him? You know what question that could be compared to? The question is, should we say Hallel on Yom Ha'atzmaut? Should we say Hallel on Yom Ha'atzmaut? That sounds like a very nice question, except rabbis have been fired because of this question, principals have been fired because of this question, teachers have been let go because of this question. All right, there are questions that are halachic questions. All right, and there are halachic questions. All right, for example, there is no halachic justification for saying Hallel in Eretz Israel on Yom Ha'atzmaut night. There's no halachas will tell you it's permitted. Now, I've been in the great synagogue where they say in a very nice Hallel. I've been there, I was in the shul that said Hallel. But halachically you can't, because the Gemara says very clearly that there's only one night in the year, and then it's got the Shalom is Pesach. That's it. There is no, you can be the biggest Zionist in the world, but if you're a halachist, you know it can't be done. Now, Chachamim can make a gezeirah, but in other words, halachically it can't be done. But when the question comes up, should you say Hallel on Yom Ha'atzmaut, it's not a halachic shayla. It's not really a halachic shayla. It's a political shayla. All right? It could be political religio. Okay? There's a combination of it. But it is a hot button issue. Very, very hot button. That was what was going on here. It was not simply a question of ma'ariv. It was a question of how do we evaluate our present political situation with regard to how the Jewish people should conduct itself after the Churban Bayis. Okay, I asked that question already. Okay. So now, interesting. Remember before when we went through this, about the Simchas Beis HaShoeva? Okay, we went through the whole day. Okay? What was missing here? Nobody asked, right? Whether they daven ma'ariv. So what's the carrots? They didn't daven ma'ariv. They didn't daven ma'ariv. Ma'ariv was a prayer of Golas. What?
Kriya Shema.
Kriya Shema is Bazunder, but that's they don't need a tehillah for that. Because they don't mention it at the beginning either. I mean, so in other words, Yaakov Avinu, Avram was reciting Shabbos, Yitzchak was reciting Mincha. Yaakov was reciting Ma'ariv when he went into Golus. Ma'ariv essentially is a prayer that's nogea to the Golus. Sun is coming down, he was going into Golus. At that time, he made a tefillah specifically aimed towards the goats. And when the Beis HaMikdash was standing, Kanira, and I checked different Gersos here, I mean, it seems pretty, most Gersos, almost all as far as I remember, I'm not sure if there are any exceptions, Ma'ariv is left out. So now the question is, what should we do? How should we treat this period? Now you have to understand, I'm going to get to this in a minute. Rabbi Gamliel, who really was the political leader of Klal Yisrael, and Rabbi Yeshua were at odds. Rabbi Yeshua felt very good about the future. Rabbi Gamliel was more of a realist. Why was Rabbi Yeshua enthusiastic. Why is it that he thought things were going to get better?
So there is a Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, where the Medrash says, "V'meir Yeshua ben Chananya, Gosra Malchus Hashor Shribona Beis Hamikdash." Okay? In other words, if you look in the Medrash Rabbah, you'll find that Hadrian gave Rabbi Yehoshua permission to rebuild the second temple. Gave him permission to rebuild the second temple. And then, as it goes on, Elston, Elaine, Pisoy, Amigadilu, Lamalta, the High Karta, Radika. No, but you're looking for trouble, they said to Hadrian. And therefore, Hadrian says, well, what can I do? I already promised it. So they said, Pasha. And for them, it was a very good Eitzah. You know, one of the important things about the Beis HaMikdash is that there's a hakpada of where the menorah, where the mizbeach is. In other words, things can be a little bit off. It's not gefilach. But the makom hamizbeach, when they reinstituted the Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara says that they had three neviim, and the function of one of the neviim was to say, this is the makom hamizbeach. So now comes Hadrian, and Hadrian is given the following Eitzah. Tell the Jews, you want to build a Beis HaMikdash? Fine. All right. But for different reasons, you can't build it exactly here. You have to move it down the block a half, half a block. Okay? So politically, it was a good move, because he was saying, so build it. I'm not stopping you from building it. But obviously, it was known that if they couldn't build it exactly where it had to be built, then it would not be the Beis HaMikdash. And at that point, people got very upset. They were in Beit Rimon, which is near Pekin, by the way, and Sipori. And Rav Yeshua had to assuage them. And this, of course, brings us to the famous story, which we know. All right, so after the building of the temple was no longer a reality, Rav Yeshua began to have second thoughts. The period after the destruction of the second temple was one of uncharted waters. And that's what we really, really have to understand. We think that we know what was rabbinic hashkofa after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. But we really have not gone la'amkon shel dvorim. The reality is, I say they were in uncharted waters. What does that mean, they were in uncharted waters? When the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, there was a nevuah. And they knew, Miketz, Shivim, Shana, and after 7 years, however you made the cheshbon, so they made wrong cheshbonis, but in the end there was a nevuah. After 7 years, the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt. That's what they knew. But when it came to the second Beis HaMikdash, ostensibly there were no such nevuahs. And the rabbis didn't know what the story was. This was the whole fight. I don't have the time to go into it. In terms of Megillas Tainis, there was a book called Megillas Tainis. And the question is, this book, which talks about the glory of the Second Temple and the miracles that took place, is it still operative or not, now that the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed? Is the era of the Second Temple over? Perhaps to be rebuilt, perhaps not to be rebuilt, or not. This was a real problem that the Chachamim faced. Okay, because we have very dire psukim, which we all know, okay, that Moshe is told by God, Hashem says to Moshe, you're going to die, and the nation is going to stray, I'm going to get angry, I'm going to abandon them, I will hide my face from them, and then they're free for anybody to attack. So now, and this of course, the whole Indian of Esther. The whole question is, what was the future of the nation of Israel? And the reality is they didn't know. The reality is they did not know. And therefore they were in a tremendous, tremendous quandary of how they should conduct themselves. And if you don't know, it's a tremendous problem. I mean, I just have to reiterate again shortly. I mean, we have a Masorah, for example, that the second Beis HaMikdash will not be rebuilt.
But it's not clear. It's not stated. It might be stated in Svarim, but from what year did the Svarim state this? It was not always that. It was an open question. And therefore, you have the famous story, I don't have to tell you, about these very same rabbis, Rabbi Leo, Rabbi Elazar Azariah, Rabbi Yeshua, we're talking about now, Rabbi Akiva, the famous story with the fox, I don't have to go into detail. They cried, Rabbi Akiva laughed, and Rabbi Akiva cites a pasuk, and he says, from this pasuk, in which two individuals are quoted, the eagerly aidin, the morning of Sobriya HaKohen, and Zachariah ben Yerachim, that these two individuals lived, one in the first base of Mikdash, one in the second base of Mikdash. Basically, what is being said here is that Rabbi Akiva is essentially finding a pasuk for them that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even after the destruction, is not going, and is refers to say after the second destruction, Rabbi Hashem is not really going to abandon the nation of Israel. And that's why, at the end, Rabbi Yeshua and the other rabbis say to Rabbi Akiva, Nichamtanu, Nichamtanu. And again, who are we talking about? We're talking about Rabbi Eliezer, we're talking about Rabbi Yeshua, the rabbis that we've been discussing until now. So that's one perspective. Now, so that is Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua is from the school of Shammai, the school of Hillel, a rationalist. He does not see Klal Yisrael at the highest of levels, and he could see the possibility that the Ribbono Shel Olam could possibly abandon Israel and deal totally with Hester Ponim, and it's not open to exactly what is going to happen and how it's going to happen and when it's going to happen. However, when it comes to Rabbi Elazar HaMadoi, all right, Derech Acheres HaSolo, he was much stronger. What we know about him is, and if you do want to learn more about him, the whole story is found in Yerushalmi Maseches Tainis, which I'm not going to go into great detail. He comes from the Shammai tradition. He was Bar Kochba's uncle. Yeah? So he was with that group. Okay, the group that strongly believed, as Rabbi Akiva, right, who just said Nechatanim, they said, Rabbi Akiva also had this very, very strong feeling that the Geula was going to take place, that they were going to be victorious, and that they will rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. As I said, he held the Jewish community in high esteem. He believed the temple could yet be rebuilt. He was a tzaddik, as the Gemara says in Tainis. His prayers protected the Jewish community. This was known by the Goyim, and therefore they wanted him dead. So what they did was they framed him, making Bar Kochba think that he consorted with them to plan his overthrow. And they convinced Bar Kochba that Rabbi Elazar HaMadoi, in fact, turned on him. Because of that, Bar Kochba had Rabbi Elazar HaMadoi executed. Very interesting mice. So you have, in essence, these two rabbis, one who, as long as in rationality he saw that there's a possibility that the temple would be rebuilt, this was his position. However, when the time came that he was told that this no longer would be, he gave it up and he says it's over. And Rabbi Elazar HaMadoi did not. So now the question comes, what is the dispute? Going back to what we began with. What did we begin with? We began with the question of whether or not Esther could be written as a Sefer in Tanakh. Now, what is the difference between a Sefer and a Megillah? Esther wrote a Megillah. Okay? When would that Megillah become a Sefer in Tanakh? When Amalek was completely annihilated. Tanakh is finished. What's there? It's over. So therefore, so zosikorim b'sefer, when did you write the sefer of Mechias Amalek? When the story is over. Tanakh is Tanakh. Doesn't change. When you're in the middle of a maisa, when Amalek is still around, to put Esther in Tanakh, That they didn't want to do. So what we find is as follows. We find that there is a machlokas between Rabbi Elazar Modoi and Rabbi Yehoshua, which is very, very pertinent in Yoneinu. And that is, we're going to read in Parsha Zohar in 2 weeks, Nechomol Hashem Ba'molek, Midor Dor. So what does it mean, Midor Dor? So on Midor Dor, we have as follows. Rabbi Yeshua says, Midor is this world. And Dor, Elu Chayo Abo. Okay? Amolek is never going to be annihilated. All right? It says, Timcha Zecha Amolek. You're going to try. Nochamo. It could be Hitli Yamachshamo. It could be all of these other splinters that we see arising. And you are going to try. You're going to win certain battles. But that is not going to be Mechias Hamolek. It could be Kimocho Emcha Zecher Hamolek. In the end, the Rebbeinu Shlom is going to have to come down and completely obliterate Hamolek. And that's going to be an Olam Haba. So until that point, it does not become a Sefer in Tanakh. So, Yeshua, the Elazar Modoi says, Midor Shamosha, Midor Shel Shmuel. There's another here that says, Ador Shel Esther. And here, we find in Pirkei Rav Elazar, Amalo Shmuel. Hashem Sheshikma Chera Vamole, Zkenechas, Bachura Yisrael, Yachari Ha'onah. In other words, the position of Rabbi Elazar Modoi, position of Rabbi Eliezer, is that what happened on Purim, okay, was all of Amalek had been totally and completely obliterated. So in other words, their shita is that you could put Esther in a sefer, because Amalek has already been eradicated. Or whatever tzuris you have, but it's not Amalek. All right, Amalek is over. Okay, Rabbi Yeshua says no, Amalek is not over, and therefore Esther could not be part of Tanakh. Now the question is, what we said before, that the Anshei Knesset Hagdola 400 years before had decided, right? The Teretz is that was then, now is now. Got to reevaluate. That's what they thought. The Maisa, that was not. That's what Rabbi Yeshua was saying. And Rabbi Elazar Hamadoi. And Rabbi Elazar would say no. In other words, whatever we're seeing now is something different. And by the way, just to mention this, we have the same machlokas binogei to Pesach. Right? In other words, are we or are we not, when we left Mitzrayim, does it mean that Golas Mitzrayim is over? And if you learn the Mefarshim on the Haggadah, then you see that that's an ongoing machlokas. There are those who say that they were roi l'geula, and then when they redeemed, Mitzrayim was over, and whatever tzuris you have, it's different tzuris, all right? And they're all saying, no, it's all a continuation of the same tzura. And this is the machlokas of whether or not you say the parsha of tzitzis, tzitzis Mitzrayim balelos. It's totally in this machlokas. So basically, that's what we have here, okay? So hopefully, what I hope I showed you was when you have a machlokas in the Gemara, you have to understand who are the combatants or disputants. You have to understand where they're coming from. You have to understand the hashgacha, and that sometimes halachic disputes have tremendous, tremendous real ramifications. So, have a happy Purim.